Blog Talk Radio. Beautiful Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. United States of America, planet Earth, third planet from the sun. I'm your host, Dr. C. Robert Jones, and I have a bit of a cold, so I'm going to try to get through this hour and without sneezing or coughing, and we'll see how it goes. I'm a little stuffy, but you know, what I'd really like to do right now is begin by giving thanks for all the wonderful things in my life. Beautiful woman, great health, happy family for the most part. And of course, yes, of course, the Republican landslide of November 2nd. Oh, sent a tingle up my leg. Quite like, and now I know how my NBC host, Chris Matthews, felt when he said that one of Obama's speeches gave him a tingle up his leg. How another man can give another man a tingle up the leg is beyond me, but that victory sure did it for me. So, I'd like to give thanks for the Republican landslide of 2010. The Republicans with their landslide victory in the midterm election. Republicans rearranged the nation's political landscape. There's no doubt about that. They strengthened their position in the Midwest, gained a foothold in the Northeast, and practically drove Democrats out of the South. Republicans also turned themselves into a more diverse party, at least at the top. Two African Americans, Alan West of Florida and Tim Scott in South Carolina, won House seats. Now, they can form a black Republican caucus if they decide to. And there's hope of that caucus growing in the near future. And by winning the Senate race in Florida, Marco Rubio, a Cuban-American, is likely to become a Republican star in Washington. And then there's Susana Martinez, who was elected governor of New Mexico, and Brian Sandoval, governor of Nevada. Both are Hispanic, and Yes, Republican. The effect of all this was to restore Republicans as a national party. Strong again in the Midwest, more dominant than ever in the South, and competitive in the Northeast. Meanwhile, the national reach of Democrats is shrinking. Hallelujah for that. Let's give thanks. Let's give thanks for that tomorrow as we sit down with our families and our friends, or even if we're alone, and give thanks for all the wonderful, wonderful things that we've had the privilege to enjoy this year. Let's give a special thanks and send a special prayer out for the Republican Party and the vast and historic majority that we have in the House, and for the shrinking majority of the Democrats in the Senate. You know, I've had some of my closest friends ask me, with great sincerity, why are you a Republican? The Republicans haven't done anything for us. The Republicans don't like black people. You know, kind of like when that moron Kanye West stated on TV, like some zombie-like message he gets sent out. George Bush don't like black people. He sounds like a little. First of all, he sounds gay. I mean, really, come on. Can we be realistic here? He sounds like a little gay kid. And he's from my hometown of Chicago. Not that there's anything wrong with being gay. Of course not. But he just sounded like a petulant little child who was just upset about his perception that George Bush didn't like black people. Well, you know, I think, and here's how I explain it. I explain it each time I'm asked about my affiliation, my conservative views. And I try to explain it on a level that I'm quite sure my friends will understand. And I explain it this way. The Democrat Party is like the slave master who, on the day of the emancipation, gathered all his Negro farmhands, all his slaves, all his workers, all the house staff, out onto the porch. And he stood on the steps of the porch and he said, "Now listen, you niggers, you can't make it out there on your own. You don't have any skills. You don't have any brains. You don't have what it takes to be free and on your own. You won't survive without me. Stay here. Stay here and work my land. And I'll give you a little bit of it, and I'll let you live on it for free. If you stay here, you'll be safe. If you work for me, because you can't make it on your own." Now, across the way, we have the Republican. He gathers all his former slaves, his field hands, house folk, and he gathers them all around as he stands on the porch and he says, "You're free. You're free. Now go. Go make your way in the world. You're on your own. It's every man for himself. Hopefully you've developed some tools and some skills along the way. if you want to stay and work here, I'll give you some land, I'll pay you a decent wage, and all will be well. If you don't, then the hell with you. Hit the bricks. You're free. Go. Make your way in the world. That story that I tell my friends is a true story. It happened just that way. Once or twice. And maybe even more than that. But I know it happened more than once. I am, after all, a master historian. The Democrats want blacks to believe that we don't have the skills, that we don't have what it takes to be free and make it on our own and do our own things because we were in bondage for 400 years. It's been 400 years, like, for 700 years. But I just guess, like, 400, you know, it just kind of has a nice ring to it, I suppose. So, for 400, like, 600, 700 years. But 400 years, we were in bondage. And we were stupid. Not very bright. No book learning. No reading, writing, arithmetic. So, for all these years, we've been behind the white man. I thought I heard a dog barking. We've been behind the white man. And so, the Republicans, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and those folks have said, look here, Negro, you can't make it on your own. You need our help so that we can give you some stuff for free. And all we ask in return is that you continue to vote us into office. And we'll continue to give you stuff for free. We'll take money from those horrible, horrible white folks. And we'll give you some. And we'll keep some. And all you got to do is continue to be poor and stupid and vote for us. Now, if you think that I'm going overboard here. Excuse me. Maybe I am a little. But the reason Condoleezza Rice became a Republican is well documented and reflects the reason why I became a Republican. And that is, she said that her father, she's from Alabama, my family and my father's side. She said that in Montgomery, her father would go to the polling place, the Democratic polling place, and he would attempt to vote as a young man, and he was turned away time and time again. You know, they would sometimes let him in, and he'd have to take a test. He'd have to prove that he could read and write, and in some cases, he had to recite segments of the Constitution. But most of the time, Condoleezza Rice's dad was turned away from the polls. Most of the time through threat of violence. And so one day, Mr. Rice, Condoleezza's dad, decided that he was going to go down the street to a Republican polling place to try and vote. Because back then, in those days, the Republican polling place voting sections were separate from Democrat. If you wanted to vote Republican, you had to go to a Republican polling place. If you wanted to vote Democrat, you had to go Democrat. So Condoleezza's dad went into the Republican polling place and, yeah, they let him in with open arms, gave him some cookies, some coffee, some iced tea, and he voted, and it was beautiful. It was groovy. Well, Mr. Rice couldn't wait to get home and tell his family. Condoleezza was in on that conversation, as she was on most of the family's important conversations, and that stuck with her. And from then on, the Rice family have been and have voted conservative and Republican. And that's a true story. So, let's give thanks tomorrow for our family and our friends, and if we're in good health for that, and for all the good things in our lives, and for our families, our wonderful families. I can't stress that enough. But also, let's set aside a little time to give thanks for the historic events that occurred on November 2nd. The effects of the historic shellacking on November 2nd restored the order of things so that there would be no one-party rule in our nation, in our country. America spoke loud and clear. It's good to be an American. I know why the caged bird sings. Do you? By the way, I can't stand that poem. And I certainly can't stand Mia Angelou. But I throw that in there because it, you know, just kind of made a little sense at that particular time. Now, on to some juicy stuff. Some really good stuff. It's X-rated, there's no doubt. Or at least PG. Strange men grope Nancy Pelosi, or the terrorist in one. As long as the head of the TSA, Long Dong Silver, refuses to get rid of the intrusive and possibly dangerous airport searches, how about requiring members of Congress to go through the same security screening in order to enter hallowed congressional office buildings? Hallowed. Not just Barney Frank, because he'd dig it. I mean, all members of Congress. We've patted you down twice, Congressman Frank. Why don't you just go into your office now? Because you know Barney, he's. The Rayburn House Office Building is far more likely a target for a terrorist attack than a random flight out of a random airport. But every passenger on every flight in America must allow a TSA agent to get to second base with them, in some cases third base, from what I've seen, and you have too, or appear live in a nude video in order to board a plane. If that's necessary to keep us airline passengers safe, why not use the same security procedures to protect our illustrious members of Congress? Digest that for a moment. According to the FAA, there were about 37,000 commercial flights per day in 2008. In mere at what, a mere 6 buildings contain the offices of every member of our country's entire legislative branch at any given time? So why shouldn't people entering those tempting terrorist targets be given the same security screening as the roughly 500,000 Americans taking random commercial flights every day? Wouldn't that make sense? Well, it can't. It just isn't done. Because Capitol Hill security guards recognize members of Congress and their staff, right? TSA agents, however, presumably recognize lots of people going through airport security. 10 to 20% of passengers are frequent flyers, taking the same routes over and over and over again. In addition, TSA agents will recognize their neighbors of 40 years, their hometown mayor, their children's teachers, local and national celebrities, actors, athletes, and so on. Famous folks. Some TSA agents probably recognize Christian Slater as the guy who sometimes has a gun in his carry-on bag. But all those people have to take their shoes off, remove their computers from their luggage, and be subjected to a pat-down because TSA agents are prohibited by Homeland Security Department from using, well, from using any common sense at all. Now, humorously enough, in 2002, Al Gore got searched at an airport. Gore may have a forgettable face, all puffy and pudgy, and he kind of looks evil, like an evil clown. Yeah, you know what he looks like. But at the airport, he had been vice president of the United States for 8 of the previous 10 years, had run for president, and then had made a spectacle of himself by demanding a recount when he got his butt whooped. Now, I, your humble host, have seen James Caan in an airport security line. Is James Caan less recognizable than Representative Steve Rothman, perhaps? Tip for the NSA. When your agents are asking passengers for their autograph, you're probably not on the verge of nabbing Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab. I hope I got that right. Why are members of the ruling class the only Americans for whom it's possible to design a security system that takes the obvious into account? One wonders. Nancy Pelosi is more likely to engage in a terrorist attack on America than any grandmother or 8-year-old. Just look at what she's done to our healthcare system. It's a terrorist attack. No doubt. And we're all going to feel that in the coming years if it's not reprieved. She has committed an act of terrorism against the United States of America. Why isn't she strip searched? Why don't we have a nice picture of her bony butt stripped down buck naked? Now, I know. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. We want to be thankful, and we don't want a picture of a naked Pelosi in our heads. She's probably had a few other things Botoxed, except besides that ugly mug of hers. Now, Pelosi opposed the Gulf War on the grounds that it would be bad for the environment. Yes, you heard me. Nancy Pelosi opposed the Gulf War on the grounds that it would be bad for the environment. Not that it would kill a whole bunch of folks and there'd be blood and guts all over the place, and that young American men and women would be in harm's way. One would think she would oppose the war for those reasons. But no. Pelosi, I'm going to say it just one more time, opposed the Gulf War on the grounds that it would be bad for the environment. She voted to reduce funds for the B-2 intercontinental bomber and repeatedly voted against a missile defense system. She voted to end Radio Marti broadcast to Cuba. She voted against the war in Iraq. She voted against a constitutional amendment to permit school prayer and against allowing state and local governments to display the Ten Commandments. She voted against all of this. No wonder she has a 100% congressional rating from Al-Qaeda. Now, if those aren't terrorist acts, you tell me what is. Besides, of course, the obvious blowing up buildings and terrorizing all America and you know, killing a whole bunch of folk, which is not funny at all. But those are acts of terrorism in my book. And yet, Pelosi is not only able to breeze into the U.S. Capitol without a search, but she can usually board a commercial airline without submitting to a groping or nude body scan that awaits the rest of us. Members of Congress and government officials are generally exempted from the TSA's airport screening. So let me ask you this. While all this is going on, is there any thought given, I wonder, aloud, to the possibility that folks like you and me will simply stop flying and find other means of transportation? Perhaps drive our cars. And with the airline industry consistently teetering on bankruptcy for the last, well, nearly 30 years. Who remembers Eastern Airlines and Pan Am? Airlines that had been in service, and TWA. Airlines that had been in service for 40 years. A couple since the age flight began. Gone. Delta. Recently come out of bankruptcy. United. The airline industry and the way it's designed loses money constantly. The airline industry has never, well, not in recent times, broken even or made a profit. That is a fact. So, why is the government making it more and more difficult and less appealing for consumers to fly? Could it be that this administration, as always, believes that we're just sheep and that we're going to follow along? Or is there something else going on here? Because, you know, in my opinion, Americans are stubborn. And if it becomes too difficult, if it becomes inconvenient to fly, then we won't. We'll find some other way to get to where we're going, or we simply won't go. And, you know, before all of this hands-on stuff started about a month ago, you know, I had the opportunity, I had a choice between flying to Fort Lauderdale and driving. And I chose to drive the 12 hours to Fort Lauderdale because I didn't want to go through the hassle while flying, and it would have only taken a couple of hours to get there from here. I don't think I'm going to be flying anytime soon if I can avoid it. So there are those in the media right now wondering, why is the government making it less and less palatable for citizens to fly on airlines in the name of safety? Could it be that the Obama administration is attempting to engineer another, quote, emergency, end quote, an emergency situation? Because as we learned after the day after the shellacking on November 2nd, Obama stated that he took over the banks, a lot of banks. He poured money into a stimulus that hasn't worked one bit. And he took over an auto industry because there was an emergency situation. He had no choice. That America was teetering on the brink of a depression. Perhaps he's attempting to create yet another emergency situation out of thin air so that he can take over the airline industry. I can't think of any other explanation as to why the government would make it so much more difficult and inconvenient for consumers to get from point A to point B on an airline. And now that Americans have made their choices known, that a lot of us won't fly, and that's been borne out today, where a lot of Americans have chosen other means of transportation, Big Sister
Janet Napolitano,
well, she sounds so sexy, doesn't she? Janet has said, well, you know, the administration is giving strong consideration to expanding our security apparatus to buses and trains and other commuter transportation devices. So now she's not satisfied that she's holding the airline industry hostage and pretty much driving them a lot of them out of business. But the government is attempting, or slowly attempting, to expand its reach into your local bus routes, Amtrak, which is government owned, Greyhound, Trailways, and so on. So that in the end, there'll be no escape. You will be felt up by a TSA agent at some point. So I guess while we're giving thanks tomorrow, tonight, and every day after, we'll have to give thanks for being felt up some point in the near future by a total stranger. Imagine, men, going into an airport with your hot wife or your hot girlfriend. She's wearing a nice pair of jeans or something and a really nice blouse buttoned down to there. And this stud, Dexter, we'll call him, TSA agent, struts up to her and runs his hand up the inner thigh of her pants leg and around her crotch area and down the other side and up her buttocks. (Clears throat) and around her breast and down the small of her back and around her butt. Now, that's unlikely to happen. Most likely there'll be a female TSA agent handling that sort of thing, but imagine that. And imagine all the men standing around watching this. Watching their wives or their girlfriends or somebody else's wife or somebody else's girlfriend being felt up. I don't like that idea. Not at all. So, speaking of transportation, excuse me, sorry, I'm catching a cold. The Obama administration is propping up faltering electric car market, the faltering electric car market. American consumers may not be embracing the concept of electric vehicles, but the Obama administration is reportedly picking up the slack in sales. According to Bloomberg, the Obama administration has purchased almost one quarter of all hybrid vehicles sold by Ford Motor Company and General Motors since 2009. So the Obama administration is purchasing these vehicles and just passing them out to a variety of government agencies in order to prop up the market. Interesting indeed. Well, all I can say is we'll see how that one works out. So, our next topic, the last topic of the evening is going to be about, well, the lost lessons of Thanksgiving. Because tomorrow is a very special day where families come together, friends, loved ones from all across the country, and hopefully everyone will have a good time. There won't be any arguing and fighting and hard feelings, and everyone will just give thanks for a variety of things. But I hope that we don't lose sight of what Thanksgiving is really all about, the lost lesson of Thanksgiving. Had today's political class been in power in 1623, tomorrow's holiday would have been called Starvation Day instead of Thanksgiving. Of course, most of us wouldn't be alive to celebrate it. Every year around this time, school children are taught about that wonderful day when pilgrims and Native Americans shared the fruits of the harvest. But few know that the first Thanksgiving in 1623 almost didn't happen. Long before the failure of modern socialism, the earliest European settlers gave us a dramatic demonstration of the fatal flaws of collectivism. Unfortunately, few Americans today know it. The pilgrims at Plymouth Colony organized their farm's economy along communal lines. The goal was to share the work and the produce equally. That's why they nearly all starved. When people can get the same return for less, with less effort, most people make less effort. Plymouth settlers faked illness rather than working the common property. Some even stole. despite their Puritan convictions, total production was too meager to support the population, and thus famine resulted. This went on for 2 years. So, as it well appeared that famine must still ensue the next year also, if not some way prevented, wrote Governor William Bradford in his diary, the colonists, he said, began to think how they might raise as much corn as they could and obtain a better crop than they had done, that they might not still thus languish in misery. At length, after much debating of things, with the advice of the chiefest among them, gave way that they should set corn every man for his own particular, and in that regard trust to themselves, and so assign to every family a parcel of land. In other words, the people of Plymouth moved from socialism to private farming, and the result was dramatic. This had every good success, Bradford wrote, for it made all hands very industrious, so as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been. By this time, harvest was come, and instead of famine, now God gave them plenty. Oh yeah, plenty. And the face of things was changed to the rejoicing of the hearts. There's a lesson for you there. A lesson about socialism and collectivism. Because of the change, the first Thanksgiving could be held in November 1623. What Plymouth suffered under communalism was what economists today call the tragedy of the commons. The problem has been known since ancient Greece. As Aristotle noted, that which is common to the greatest number has the least care bestowed upon it. If individuals can take from common pot, regardless of how much they put in, each person has an incentive to be a free rider, to do as little as possible and take as much as possible, because what one fails to take will be taken by someone else, and soon the pot is empty. Apply this well-known fact to perhaps unemployment insurance being extended to 99 weeks. You think a person's going to be incentive and have incentive enough to go out and get a job when they're getting money for free for doing nothing for 99 weeks? What private property does, as the Pilgrims discovered, is connect effort to reward, creating an incentive for people to produce far more than if there's a free market. People will trade their surplus to others for the things they lack. Mutual exchange for mutual benefits makes the community richer. Here's the biggest irony of all. The U.S. government has yet to apply the lesson to its first conquest, Native Americans. The U.S. government has held most Indian land in trust since the 19th century. This discourages initiative and risk-taking, among other reasons. It can't be used as collateral for loans. On Indian reservations, private land is 40 to 90% more productive than land owned through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, says economist Terry Anderson, executive director of PERC. If you drive through Western reservations, you will see on one side cultivated fields, irrigation, and on the other side overgrazed pasture, run-down pastures and homes. One is simple commons. The other side is private property. You have Indians on both sides, and the important thing is someone owns one side. So the lesson is, if you give someone something for nothing, that does not provide incentive to actually go out and earn anything on your own to produce. And I think the Obama administration doesn't fully understand this. For all his Obama's brilliance and majesty and magic and deity, he doesn't really understand that by giving someone something from nothing, or giving someone something that taking from one group of people and giving to another without them having earned any of it, does not provide incentive for those folks to actually go out and do their own things. You know, I like to state that, I have stated in the past that when someone gave me something that I didn't earn, I'll admit that I was less apt to take good care of it the way I would if I worked hard and purchased it myself. If I earned what I have, I am more inclined to take very good care of it, as opposed to something that was given to me. Now, of course there are caveats to that. If I've been given something from my mom or my dad or a loved one, of course. Because in a way that I have earned those things. But if someone walks up to me off the street and just says, hey, here's a new car. Well, I'm going to take the car and I'm going to drive down the road. But it's just not the same as if I worked really hard and purchased the car myself. That pride of ownership, hard work, the fact that I suffered to get what I got, it's not there when you're given something for nothing. And that's what this administration wants to do with their ambitions of fundamentally transforming the United States of America and the redistribution of wealth. How many times have any of you heard that phrase before Obama came into office? Redistribution of wealth. He believes in it. He's talked about it many times. He's recorded as stating that the Supreme Court, after the Civil Rights Movement, never took up the issue of redistribution of wealth, taking from one segment of the American population and giving to another, those considered to be less fortunate. Well, tomorrow we're all going to be together with our family and friends, and we're going to give thanks for the good things we have in our lives. And no doubt, a lot of us are fortunate to have people we love and respect sitting beside us and giving thanks. So, I'm going to close this program because I'm starting to feel the effects of my terrible, awful cold. So I'm going to close early. And I want to wish you all a happy, happy, healthy Thanksgiving tomorrow. And we'll talk we'll talk again on Friday, and we'll talk about all the food we ate, and all the people we met, and all the good friends and family that came together the day before. And I hope that tomorrow is not just celebrated as a day where we all get together and eat food and watch football, because I'll be doing both those things, but a day of reflection and introspection. I wish you all a good night and a wonderful, wonderful day tomorrow.
I was walking home from school on a cold winter day. Took a shortcut through the woods, and I lost my way. It was getting late, and I was scared and alone. But then a kind old man took my hand and led me home. My mama couldn't see him, oh, but he was standing there. And I knew in my heart he was the answer to my prayers. Oh, somewhere up above, they come to you and me in our darkest hours to show us how to live, to teach us how to give, to guide us with the light of love. When life held troubled times and had me down on my knees, there's always been someone to come along and comfort me. A kind word from a stranger, to lend a helping hand, a phone call from a friend, just to say I understand. But ain't it kind of funny, at the dark end of the road, that someone lights the way with just a single ray of hope? Oh, I believe there are angels among us, sent down to us from somewhere up above. They come to you and me in our darkest hours to show us how to live, to teach us how to give, to guide us with the light of love. They wear so many faces, show up in the strangest places, to grace us with their mercy in our time of need. Oh, I believe there are angels among us, sent down to us from somewhere up above. They come to you and me in our darkest hours to show us how to live, teach us how to give, to guide us with the light of love, to guide us with the light of love.